This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, if you're an investor, you've probably not seen a year like this since 2015 or 2016, when we saw volatility spikes not seen since the Great Recession. And it doesn't matter where you look, from stocks to bonds to commodities, all asset classes have been on what seems to be a giant roller coaster ride. So what we're going to cover here now is the price of oil and what just happened. Oil prices had been rising all year, and they reached a peak in the first week in October with calls for $100 oil by year end. And as we sit here on this Friday, the price of oil is hovering in the mid-50s. A month ago, it was in the mid-70s. So you're probably thinking, what the hell just happened? How can we go from record prices for the year and calls for $100 oil by year end to a bear market in oil with prices in the 50s in just 1 month? What changed? Why so dramatic a fall in just a short time? Is this a sign of an approaching recession? Maybe a new glut in oil? The peak of the business cycle? Major new supplies of oil? Why the dramatic drop in oil? And does this even make any sense? This is what we're going to talk about in this segment of The Big Picture as we try to make sense of what just happened.
You know, this has really puzzled a lot of people, and there are a lot of technical factors because the oil market is the largest commodity market in the world, but it is controlled by the futures market, which is leverage. So whenever money comes into the futures market on a bullish bet, it can drive the price up oil, as we saw in late September and October. And conversely, Chris, when things start to fall, it can drive the prices lower, as we saw in the month of October and early November. So what we have seen in the price of oil is probably the steepest fall in oil prices in over 3 years. You would have to go back to, let's say, 2014 or 2015 to see anything like it in terms of what we saw last month. And you remember what happened in 2014. The price of oil was going down. Supplies were increasing as a result of American shale. And OPEC thought they would put an end to American shale producers by going all out, producing oil, driving the price down, flooding the markets with oil, which it did. It drove the price down to $26 a barrel in the first part of 2016. But they weren't counting on American shale and a competitive capitalistic economy. Because what did the shale producers do? They brought down the cost of shale. It dropped every single year. And today, we'll get into in just a moment, U.S. oil. And the U.S. is now become the largest oil producer in the world. But fears of a new oil glut, a global recession, have gripped the market. So what caused this steep decline in the price of oil? There are three main factors. Well, actually four if you throw technicals. Really, two of them caused the steep decline. To sum it all up, the precipitous drop in oil that we've seen over the last month was a story called Made in America. As I will explain, it is the combination of these factors that produced such a steep drop in prices in such a short time.
This sudden drop is certainly in line, Jim, with so much of what we've seen all year long. And stock prices, they started out the year week after week with new records, and then only to give it all back in 6 days. It happened again to stock prices in early October after it had set records in all the major indexes. And then, yep, we gave it all back, and we still remain on shaky ground as we record this podcast. The same thing is happening with oil, having hit $86 on Brent and almost $77 on WTI. We're now looking at $66 and $56 for oil prices globally. So how do you explain what just happened?
You know, as I said, this is a problem made in America. There are three factors behind the change in perceptions as to why oil dropped so quickly, and I'm going to add a fourth factor, which is technicals. The first and foremost was the 8 waivers the Trump administration gave to countries regarding the Iranian sanctions. The second was a major increase in U.S. shale oil production. And the third, which you've been hearing a lot about, is the slowdown in global economic growth. Of the three, probably the biggest one was the granting of waivers, and we'll get into that shortly.
Well, Jim, let's take each one of those and explain them more fully. Oil prices have gone from zero to 60 in just a few seconds, it seems. So I'm sure a lot of listeners would like to know, what the hell happened?
Well, let's begin with the Iranian sanctions, which sort of set the stage from terms of what we saw happen in oil prices beginning this summer. The Iranian sanctions went into effect on November 5th. Now, the president announced he was withdrawing from the nuclear deal with Iran back in May, and that those sanctions would go into effect 90 days after August 6th. So that was the November 5th date that we were talking about. This is what the oil markets began to anticipate. So if you look at the charts of a price of oil, it began to rise this year as the big glut disappeared as a result of OPEC's cutbacks began to tighten the oil markets. Remember, they announced that, and it took until about late 2017 before all that glut of oil that was created when they were producing all out began to dissipate. So we began this year talking about a tightening oil market versus talk about a glut the previous 3 years. Prices began to escalate even faster after the withdrawal was announced from the nuclear agreement, which was reached with the Obama administration. Markets began to assess the impact of Iranian oil taken off the markets being added to the drop in production in Venezuelan oil production, because Venezuela's oil production is down by almost 1 million barrels. So the market was thinking, what is going to happen? Because up to the peak, Iran was exporting 2.8 million barrels a day. So the market began to say, wait a minute, we've had Venezuelan oil production go down. Now you're talking about taking several million barrels of oil off the market, and the estimates range from anywhere from 500,000 barrels to several million barrels. As prices rose throughout the summer, the president began tweeting about artificially high oil prices as a result of OPEC production cutbacks. So the president began hammering OPEC for cutting back production given the impending Iranian sanctions, which is what they did. Both Saudi Arabia and Russia ramped up production ahead of the sanctions. The oil markets were fearing this energy crunch would take place as we got to November when the sanctions went into full effect. And as I mentioned, nobody knew exactly how much was going to be taken off the market, because there's various ways the Iranians have been able to skirt the sanctions. Would it be 1 million barrels, 2 million barrels? It didn't matter. A significant chunk of oil was going to be taken off the market. And those estimates were all over the place, depending on who you were reading, depended on where they were projecting oil. Remember, leading up to this, oil was at, as you mentioned, Chris, 86 on Brent and 70, almost 77 on WTI. If those sanctions went into effect, we could be at $100 oil, which I think we could have had those waivers not been granted. So OPEC ramped up production, undoing most of their production agreement cutbacks. Then what happens? November 5th comes. What does Trump do? He grants waivers to 8 countries, including the largest consumer of oil, which was China, India, Japan, and South Korea. So if you're the president and you want to bring down the price of oil, mission accomplished, Mr. President. So in my opinion, and the second reason why we saw oil prices drop so fast the way they did. So, I mean, it was, you take a look at this. All summer long, all we talked about in the oil market, all traders were betting on what's going to happen to the market with the combination of several million barrels coming off the market with sanctions, Venezuelan oil production dropping down to almost 1 million barrels, and the oil market was tightening. So the oil markets were figuring a tight market with the loss of Iranian production, and there were doubts as to whether the Saudis had the wherewithal to make up the losses of Iran, even though they were ramping up production to the highest level in years.
Now, what about the second reason, which is U.S. shale production? It's now at record levels not seen before, with the United States now surpassing Russia to become the largest oil producer in the world.
Yeah, this is the second major factor. Originally, it was thought the U.S. production would increase by maybe 500,000 to 600,000 barrels a day this year. That was grossly underestimated. U.S. production reached 11.6 million barrels a day in the first week of November and could possibly hit 12 million barrels a day next year. The U.S. earlier in the year surpassed Saudi Arabia to become the second largest producer of oil, and then recently in the month of October and November, the U.S. finally surpassed Russia to become the largest producer in the world. So if you want to talk about oil today in the globe, you're talking about three players. The United States, which is the 800-pound gorilla in the world, then you have Russia and Saudi Arabia. So what you have now is OPEC Plus, which is OPEC and Russia, which is mainly ramping up production. They've been ramping that production up by over a million barrels since June in order to offset in advance of losses that were expected to come from Iran once those sanctions snapped back. So now you have the three largest oil producers in the world, OPEC, Russia, and the U.S., producing all out ahead of the loss coming from the sanctions. And voila, the sanctions, well, they were granted waivers. And when those sanctions went into effect, when he gave those sanctions to China, which is the world's largest consumer of oil, then you have India, another large consumer, growing consumer of oil, Japan and South Korea, you're talking next to the United States, the largest consumers of oil in the world. So just in a short time, we went from talking about oil spikes in a tight market to now talking of another oil glut.
It's just really fascinating how this thing just gets jumbled up, and we go from one expectation all the way doing a 180. It really makes the topic, I don't want to say an exciting one, because there really are concerns about economic factors around the world. And speaking of which, Jim, let's go to a clip we have from Bloomberg that explains much of what we've just discussed.
I mean, I think that's the question everyone wants to know the answer to right now. It's hard to say when you've had huge volatility spikes where the floor is. This was an avalanche of selling pressure that just hit the commodity. And if you get in front of an avalanche, you might get buried. So I think we have certainly saw a deceleration of the supply and the technicals pushing it lower. But finding a floor is going to take more time. You can't just pick a day and say, here's the floor necessarily. What drove this move was a lot of factors. It was supply. It was demand. It was technicals. It was risk off on global assets. So I think you're going to need to see some consolidation and more data before you can come out and claim we found a floor.
So, Jim, with them talking about the floor and supply and demand, I know the third factor is slowing economic growth. That has certainly been in the news lately and has also been a big factor.
Yeah, there have been a number of agencies, Chris, from the IMF to Wall Street economists that have been pointing to a global slowdown in growth as a result of central banks raising interest rates to the impact of trade wars on economies, especially China, the world's second largest economy. In fact, this week, Germany reported its economy shrank for the first time in 3.5 years by 0.8%. Germany is Europe's anchor economy. And you have to ask yourself, if things are slowing in Germany, what is happening to the rest of the Euro-bloc countries? The Eurozone economy grew by only 0.7% in the third quarter, its weakest performance since 2013. In slowing economic growth, the negative growth doesn't stop with Germany. Japan's economy contracted by 1.2% in the same quarter. There is no question that the global economy is entering a mature phase in slowing down. And the trade war is definitely impacting China, and China is impacting Germany and Japan, who are some of its largest exporters. The trade conflict between the U.S. and China is now becoming a burden on the global economy. So as economies slow down, obviously they're going to use less energy, so oil demand estimates have been coming down in the second half of the year. I've seen estimates we were going to grow this year by 1.5 to 1.6 million barrels a day. Those estimates have now come down to about 1.4 to 1.3 million barrels a day. Still growing, I have to add. So if you add all three of these factors, you add them all up, instead of sticking to their production cuts, which were working for OPEC plus Russia, they ramped up production based on tweets and urging from the president. When you combine OPEC ramping up productions, going back on their production cuts, and then U.S. shale production reaching record levels, it helped to build up inventories as production increased and global growth slowed. I want to point out, you always see inventory builds around this time of the year, especially after the summer driving season is over. What happens after that? The weather is nice. People are using less energy. The temperatures are nice. And also you have refineries that go on routine maintenance. So they shut down and they're not consuming oil, which means inventories are building. So we're in the shoulder months of the year when the weather has been nice and refineries shut down, but that is ending. Refineries are going back online, so those inventory builds should begin to moderate or at least shrink.
And Jim, I'm curious about where things stand right now going forward, because obviously with all the drama from Saudi Arabia with the Khashoggi killing, what do you see looking ahead?
Well, you know, think if you're Saudi Arabia, which wants to take its oil company Aramco public in 2021. They need higher oil prices. For the Saudi economy to work, they need $80 oil on Brent. And if you're Saudi Arabia and you've got an agreement with the United States, the president comes out and says, hey, look, your biggest enemy is Iran. You're fighting a proxy war in Yemen with Iran. And we're going to go after Iran. We're going to cut off their oil exports. So help us out here. Increase production, which is what they did. And then all of a sudden, sanctions are due to go effect. And the president says, oh, by the way, we're going to grant waivers to everybody. What are you going to do? You don't want the oil price to drop. You don't want to go through another oil glut. So what did we see this week? Saudi Arabia announced they are cutting back production by 500,000 barrels a day starting next month and may cut back even more if necessary to maintain prices and avoid what they went through between 2014 and 2016. And here's the thing, OPEC underestimated for the second time American shale oil producers to produce more oil. They're getting more efficient. It used to be the break-evens on shale was somewhere in the 65, 70. It's gone down to 50. It's gone down to 40. And here's another thing that's happening with shale. And we saw this in the financial crisis. You know, it was the small companies that got into fracking and shale. They're the guys that started this whole thing. But now the big boys are at it. You've got big companies like Exxon, Chevron, Occidental Petroleum have moved into the Permian Basin. Their oil production from shale is up 80%. And unlike the little guys, the oil companies, and especially the big ones, are flush with cash. They have access and priority with pipelines. They have the cash flow, the financing to do it, and they have the expertise. So the big guys are in oil. So OPEC's learned their lesson in the last glut when they thought they could drive shale producers out of business by pumping all out and driving down prices. They still plan on going public, as I mentioned, with Aramco. I've heard anywhere late 2020 to 2021. But the big oil companies are driving the shale production. The big boys are in the business. So look for more talk about cuts in production at the OPEC meeting in Vienna next month. The Saudis, as I mentioned, need higher oil prices to fund their government, the proxy war they're fighting in Yemen, and to fund these big infrastructure projects that make their economy less dependent on oil.
I mean, when you mention Aramco in 2021, I mean, these are things that can really impact oil. I'm expecting we're probably going to have some great shows coming up in the future when we see some of these things unfold. But what about China? I mean, what do you believe lies in store for the oil markets for the rest of the year? How does China fit into that?
You know, China, even though their economy has been slowing down, China is still increasing in buying more energy. Their imports are up this year over last year. I mean, once you turn a Chinese citizen into a car owner, he's consuming petroleum. He's buying gasoline. And the other thing that's impacting China is Chinese production, oil production, with its big oil companies, has been falling each year as a result of depletion. So that forces China into the markets to buy more oil. So despite what you've heard about a slowing economy, look at what China is actually consuming. They're consuming more oil. So, Chris, if we're looking at in terms of what's in store for the markets and investors the rest of the year, I believe the Saudis and OPEC will do what they need to do to defend prices and avoid another oil glut. The kingdom has already announced 500,000 barrel a day cut next month, despite Trump's tweets. Secondly, another major factor, as I just talked about, is not just for oil, but also the stock market is the trade deal with China. Now, the president is going to meet with the president of China on November 20th, I think, in South America. And it's widely anticipated the trade war, which has been really impacting all the major economies, it's not just China. You know, we saw a negative GDP print in Germany, which is the leader in Europe. We saw a negative GDP print in Japan. So it's not just China. It's impacting all of the developed world. It's driving up prices for manufacturers. It's driving up inflation. So if you're the president, do you want an aggressive Fed responding to rising inflation as a result of these tariffs or wobbling financial markets as you plan your bid for the second term in the presidency? The elections just ended last week, but the big election just began, and that's the run for the presidency in 2020. That pre-election bid has just begun in both parties, including the president. Most likely, we're probably going to see oil trade, I would say in the short term, anywhere from 55 to 65, depending on the news, which is good for the economy and the markets and also oil producers. $65 oil, shale producers are making a lot of money. And remember, the big guys in shale right now, Exxons, the Chevrons, the Occidentals, the big boys are in this game now, and they're well-financed.
So a lot coming up that sounds like it's going to influence the direction that oil goes. You mentioned the meeting coming up this Tuesday. You mentioned the 2020 election. But I do want to remind our listeners that we did a show on November 15th, we interviewed Roberto Aguilera. He wrote the book, The Price of Oil. Really interesting interview for our listeners that want to get even more information about this. But given the fact that so much is coming up, Jim, that can affect oil, as an investor, what do investors do with this information?
You know, Chris, I've been bullish on oil all year. If you've listened to this program, I've stated so. I expect OPEC to cut, mainly the Saudis. Demand is still growing globally, even though it has been reduced by slower growth. I also expect at some point we're going to settle this trade war with China, which will help all countries. So I believe OPEC is going to cut production if the price continues to weaken and inventories begin to build. They want to avoid another oil glut. That oil glut backfired on OPEC. Everybody got hurt. And now that refineries are back online after maintenance season, inventory builds should begin to moderate, and the oil markets will move on to talk about something else. This is one area of the market, at least in my opinion, that remains undervalued. You've got low PEs, high dividends, growing earnings for a much-needed product.
He wrote the article Trains, Planes, and Dot-Coms, detailing the euphoria in technology stocks and the bubble it represented 3 months before the peak in the NASDAQ. He wrote the article The Next Big Thing in April of 2002, pointing out the crossroads of a bear market fueled by monetary expansion, only to birth the next bull market in commodities. He wrote yet another prescient article in December of 2006 called The Next Rogue Wave, detailing the out-of-control credit expansion in developed economies a year before the global financial crisis began. You may know him from his weekly financial podcast, The Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava has been educating the public on personal finances, investing, and the financial markets for over 30 years. He closed off his seminars to the public to focus only on his clients. Now, for the first time since the 90s, he is opening up his wealth of knowledge on the markets back to the public. Call 888-486-3939 for more information or tune in now to his podcast, The Financial Sense News Hour, on iTunes and iHeartMedia to hear what he's saying now.
Well, if you ignore the stock market this week, it's actually been a pretty good year for the economy. It's been good for investors. It's been good for consumers. The economy this year has grown at the fastest rate of the whole economic recovery. Unemployment is at multi-decade lows, and workers' wages are rising at the fastest rate in a decade, up 3.1% year over year. Also, consumer confidence remains at high levels. Now, even though stocks have given back much of their gains for the year, they're still up. So corporate profits, thanks to the tax cuts, they've been growing at a double-digit clip each quarter. Inflation remains low in the 2% range. And if you're a saver, interest rates have been rising and are no longer at 0%. To sum it up, this is as good as it gets. So the question is, will all these good things in the economy and markets continue? Or could they possibly even get better? Or could there be dark clouds on the horizon that may be invisible to the naked eye?
Well, Chris, you probably summed it up pretty well. This is as good as it gets. I mean, economic growth peaked in the second quarter of this year when we hit 4.2%, a 4% number that we haven't seen since the last decade. And it's recently slowed down. If we take a look at Q3 of this year, it's down to about 3.5%. And they're expecting growth to decelerate in future quarters to around 2%. And then, of course, if we head into a recession, we'll get into negative territory by 2020. Even the Fed's own forecast are only calling for 2% economic growth this year. That's about half of what we've been tracking in the second and third quarter. And we've seen it in various sectors in the economy, as we talked about. We've seen it in housing, which peaked in May. Auto sales have also peaked as the cost of financing large ticket items goes up, as you can imagine, every time the Fed continues to raise interest rates. So in the future, buying a home, getting a mortgage, or buying a car is going to get more expensive. And if we look at some of the key, let's say, indicators in the rest of the economy, the ISM manufacturing and service indexes, I believe we've seen a peak in those, and that came late summer. And what we're seeing in those reports, as well as other economic reports, higher wages, which are up 3.1% year over year. The labor market is tight. Material costs have been rising as a result of tariffs, which is eating into profit margins. And you're seeing that in the prices paid components in the various economic indexes. Now, we got a good report on retail sales last month. It's up a healthy clip year in the month. It's up about 0.8%. So the previous 2 months, it was actually negative. But if you look at the 0.8%, it's up, but not in a good way. It was up because of consumers spending a lot more on gasoline at gas stations. As the cost of energy for most consumers rose in the month of October, the result of surging oil prices leading up into the month.
So that's some sobering information, Jim. Are you saying, based on that, that things may go downhill from here?
Well, I don't know if maybe going downhill, but we're definitely going to be slowing down from here on out as interest rates start to take their toll on the economy. The Fed is hoping their rate hikes slow the economy and raise the unemployment rate, both of which they believe in their own minds are unsustainable at these levels and a potential inflationary threat.
So given an inflationary threat, are there other risks you see? And what are some other concerns that you feel that our listeners should be maybe keeping their eye on?
You know, plain and simple, I think the big one is debt. Underlying all of this is leverage in our economy is at record levels, is suggesting sooner or later as the economy weakens, the Fed raises rates, credit spreads should begin to move up and much higher than where they are now. Currently, they remain muted, and there isn't much of a margin for investors to compensate for risk. And I think, you know, what we saw happen with GE bonds this last week, tumbling could be the canary in the coal mine. Now, the borrowing binge, and here is putting this in perspective, because you heard a lot over the last decade, oh, we're deleveraging. That was one of the reasons we had slow growth. We're trying to get rid of all the debt that was built up in the last decade. But the borrowing binge in the last decade by corporations has raised corporate debt levels to over $9 trillion, while the leveraged loan market has risen to over $1 trillion. Corporate bond issuance has been averaging $1 trillion every year, and that has been going on since 2010. The corporate bond market is nearly doubled since the financial crisis, and we have a bubble in the corporate bond market, in my opinion, that eventually, Chris, sooner or later, is going to burst as the Fed keeps driving up interest rates and raises the cost of borrowing for consumers, for government, and for corporations.
Yeah, there was an article in Friday's Wall Street Journal on debt with quite a bit of information about the amount of borrowing and delinquency based on that. But let me play devil's advocate here, Jim. You and others have been reporting on the fact that corporate profits are at record levels, averaging 25% per quarter, thanks to the tax cuts. Corporate cash, though, is also at high levels. So wouldn't this seem to mitigate some of the risks of high leverage?
Well, I mean, if you look at the surface, what you say is true. Things in the aggregate, cash levels are high, corporate profit margins have been high thanks to the tax cuts. But cash at high levels, but it is, here's the key point, it's concentrated within a narrow group of companies, mainly technology and healthcare. I mean, think of the large amount of cash that's concentrated in companies like Apple, Microsoft, Google, Berkshire Hathaway, Pfizer, and other large tech and healthcare companies. So, Chris, you know, a lot of that cash is concentrated at the top, so that skews these numbers. You subtract and take out big tech and healthcare from these numbers, and the picture changes dramatically. And furthermore, as we get into next year, when it comes to corporate earnings, you know, what we do when we get to Q1 next year, they're going to be comparing Q1 2019 to Q1 2018 when we got those tax cuts. So year-over-year comparisons are going to become more difficult. And already we've seen this in third quarter earnings. Several companies are talking about what are we seeing? Rising wages, rising material costs, and a lot of that is starting to eat into profits. And when it comes to tax cuts, even though they don't expire till 2025, they are gradually going to phase out. And for many Americans, they're going to see their tax bills go up subtly beginning next year.
Well, wait a minute. I thought the tax cuts don't get phased out till 2025.
Not so fast, Grasshopper. The IRS.
I don't know.
I don't know where that came from, but what the hell? No, but seriously, the IRS announced on Thursday the tax code parameters for 2019. And what they're going to be doing, and here's a little gotcha that nobody kind of found out about, they're going to be implementing a new and improved, I love the word improved, method for calculating inflation adjustments that are going to result in greater tax revenues to the Treasury over time. The shift, according to the Wall Street Journal, will produce an additional $135 billion of additional taxes over the next decade, beginning next year. Now, let me explain how this is working. The IRS is switching to a different, slower-moving measure of inflation to adjust a variety of tax code features for rising prices. This applies to, let's say, the standard deduction, which gets raised every year by the inflation rate, tax brackets, and other items. Basically, what the government is doing here is they're going to be understating inflation rates when it comes to indexing things like tax brackets and the standard deduction. Well, what does that mean to you, the taxpayer? The result is, as inflation rises, as wages go up, Americans are going to be paying more taxes, pushed into higher tax brackets every year going forward. Let me give you an example of how this applies. The standard deduction under the new tax law, because they got rid of most itemized deductions, is $24,000 for a family this year. Now, the IRS announced this week, because of inflation, next year the standard deduction goes to $24,400. So you're thinking, oh, great, an extra $400. And that's a result of inflation. But that is as it's measured under the new method. If they kept the old method, which measured inflation in more traditional ways, the deduction would have risen to $24,550, or basically another $150. Now, a taxpayer in a 24% bracket is going to pay $36 more in taxes each year starting next year. Now, you're thinking, oh, big deal. Well, it doesn't sound like much, but it'll get worse every year. Let's take Americans in the upper tax bracket of 37%. their taxes will go up by $3,820 by 2025. Now, you multiply these numbers by tens of millions of taxpayers, and you will have more of your money going to taxes each year, not to mention rising inflation. So that's going to help the government in a number of ways. Number one, it's going to lower the level of inflation by which your tax brackets get indexed, supposedly to keep you even. And they're also going to be applying it to entitlements. Think of, let's say, Social Security increases. If they can lower the rate of inflation, what does that do? That saves the government money. That means lower increases to Social Security each year. So they're going to be applying it to taxes and also to payments to recipients.
So as we look out at the horizon, Jim, I mean, I know last week we discussed going into next year that the economy would be facing more headwinds than tailwinds, and that's from rising interest rates as a result of Fed rate hikes. We've got political uncertainty now as a result of the changes in Washington with the Democrats taking over the House in January, but also the impact of rising prices as a result of the trade war. And by the way, tougher year-over-year comparisons for corporate earnings. So given all that, what are the risks that things could go south even earlier than you expect?
I mean, there's always that risk. I mean, you have the consensus that says the recession will probably arrive on our doorsteps by 2020. And that's the consensus. And we were sort of originally in that camp, but we now think it could arrive much earlier as a result of political changes in Washington. Last week, we talked about, will the Democrats legislate or investigate? And just listening to the chairs of the various committees this week, it looks like investigate and harass, from calls for new investigations into the president, calls for raising the minimum wage, to raising corporate tax rates to 25%, to raising taxes on upper-income Americans, and new regulations. So what does that do? It creates more uncertainty going forward and adds another element of risk to rising Fed rate hikes. So here we're watching right now, we're looking at two things. We're paying close attention to our anticipatory indicators, watching for a slowdown in the economy, which is what these indicators are telling us now. I expect GDP growth to be even slower in the fourth quarter of this year. The other thing we're monitoring closely is the credit markets, because I've said this over and over again, that is where, if there's trouble on the horizon, that's where it's going to show up first. So right now, spreads between high-quality sovereigns, high-quality debt is narrow, but it shows signs of rising. Investors are not being compensated for the risk they are taking. I mean, if you take a look at a lot of the bonds that are coming out, covenant restrictions on debt have loosened up, leverage is rising in two major sectors of the economy. It's not just government debt, but it's also corporate debt. And one reason, you've heard the U.S. budget deficit is rising, I think it was $200 billion in the month of October, is because the government is spending more on paying out more interest on its debt. The debt is bigger and rising to the tune now of almost $1 trillion a year. And let's face it, 2 years ago, the 10-year Treasury was 1.3%. If you were in T-bills, you got zero. That's not the case today. Three-month T-bills are over 2.25%. And 10-year treasuries are over 3%. And to put this in perspective, by the year 2020, the government is going to spend more on interest expense than they do on Medicaid. By 2023, this is a big one, they will be spending more on interest than they do on national defense in its entirety. And by 2025, they'll be spending more on interest than the entire discretionary budget of the government. So the era of trillion-dollar deficits are back. The government debt is, at least for now, a problem for the next decade. But here's the real problem that could unfold next year is the corporate debt market. Corporate debt has been rising and almost double where it was 10 years ago. The covenant-lite loans are finding their way into different sectors of the leveraged loan market, from CDOs to CLOs. CDOs are collateralized debt obligations, and CLOs are collateralized loan obligations. And it's not just that. It's the enormous amount of BBB debt. Now, that's just one step above junk bonds. What happens when the economy weakens? You'll see A lot of the credit agencies will start to downgrade debt because what happens in the economy? When you go into a recession or the economy weakens, revenues drop, profits drop, the ability to carry and support interest payments also drops. So a lot of these triple B rated bonds are going to be downgraded to double B or even below that, which will make them junk bonds. And what that causes, if you are a high quality, let's say corporate bond fund or ETF, you're owning a triple B, which is a lot of this debt, a third of the corporate debt in the world right now, or at least in the US, is triple B rated. So that means if it gets downgraded to double B, you are forced to sell those bonds. So if you're looking at all the outstanding corporate debt, about a third of it is investment grade. Another third is triple B, and the rest is just junk and leveraged loans. So the only thing keeping things from falling is interest rates are still at historical levels. Even though they've been going up, if you look at historically, we're still at a low level. I mean, a Fed funds rate at 2.25%, when it averaged between 3 and 6%, we're still below that. And the other thing is debt has been able to be rolled over. The economy's booming, so lenders and investors are willing to roll over debt. But watch what happens when it doesn't. Think Toys R Us and Sears.
Oh, don't get me started again on Toys R Us. In fact, if listeners want to get more information on specifically what Jim just referred to there, our October 20th big picture titled When Giants Fall, boy, if you want to just get depressed or keep an eye out to what may be happening with other companies, tune into that show October 20th. But one issue, Jim, where I know you've gone into some depth on this program, and I recall you mentioning it at this year's strategy conference, has been the lack of liquidity in the financial markets, especially in the bond markets. Is that still a big concern?
Chris, this is a major concern of ours that we've been talking about throughout this whole year. If you look at the big banks as a result of Dodd-Frank, they've reduced their prop desk, their trading desk, and their dealer inventories. And you really needed those big banks to come in and step in and provide liquidity when they were selling. So bank dealer inventories are a fraction of what they used to be. And the largest owners of these corporate debt that we're talking about here are bond funds and bond ETFs. And here's the question, you know, I've even asked this to just about every guest we have on the program. What happens when they get large liquidation notices, let's say in a market downturn, or let's say a market panic when investors wake up one day and say, oh my God, I'm losing money in my bond funds, which they're starting to do now. How are they going to unload that debt? And who will they be selling to? We simply don't know how this will play out. My gut tells me this is not going to play out well.
Well, and summing it all up, when it comes to the economy, what we've seen this year leading up to the final quarter, as I mentioned, it's just as good as it gets. And that's something that is great to report, but we also want to learn from it. And it sounds like you expect economic growth to weaken going forward, and there are more headwinds heading into next year on the political front and with the Fed hiking interest rates in this highly leveraged market. So it's expect lots more volatility going into next year. And if I'm hearing you correctly, Jim, the recession that everyone expects in 2020 could arrive much sooner. So listeners, fasten your seatbelts. Now, what should investors be doing here if this is, as you say, as good as it gets? I know when things are looking good with the economy, as they do right now, it's hard to imagine a storm on the horizon.
You know, I'm a sailor, so I'm going to go back to my weather analogy. Just to picture yourself, you're on the beach, the winds are calm, the sun is shining, and it's a warm, balmy day. But offshore, you know from the weather report, there's a tropical storm building off the coast of Africa. Now, what you never know when it comes to weather, we don't know how strong the storm will be, the direction of its path, or the time of its arrival. We just know it's lurking out there. So if you're an investor, you should be thinking about de-risking. I mean, we are in the late stages of a business cycle, and the Fed has gotten more aggressive with its rate hikes. So if you are in the bond markets, you should be thinking quality, number one, in short term, number two, and especially if you are in bond funds. We prefer, you know, high quality individual bonds with short maturities. and interest rate floaters that take advantage of rising interest rates. With a short-term bond, let's say I own a bond that's 2 years of maturity or 3 years of maturity, I don't have to worry about interest rate risk. In 2 years, 3 years, I get my money back. My interest rate will never change. I have dependable income. If I have, for example, an interest rate floater, well, if you own interest rate floaters and the Fed is raising interest rates, you got to be a happy camper. If the Fed raises interest rates a quarter point next month, that means the interest rate on your bond is going to go up by another quarter of a point. Think of adjustable rate mortgage. It's the same thing. There are bonds that adjust up and down depending on what's going on in interest rates. Now, if you are in stocks, you should be defensive or at least think of value where yields are high, PE multiples are low, and the companies have experienced significant pullbacks or corrections. I mean, that's at least where we're shopping when we're looking at stock market. We're getting defensive. We're thinking of value. We're looking for things that are beaten up, low price multiples. We think that's going to be a safer place to be.
Well, Jim, a final question then. Is there anything that could change this scenario that comes to mind, or even something that could alleviate some of the headwinds that you mentioned?
You know, there are probably three things that come to mind that could alleviate some of these concerns. The first, obviously, would be the Fed to go on pause. Let's say they raise interest rates in the month of December, and they say, you know what, for the first couple of months next year, we're just going to kind of lay back and just see what happens, especially if they get a lower print on GDP in the second quarter. Let's say we go from 3.5, we go down to 2.5. You know, the Fed should be sitting back and maybe saying, maybe we ought to just wait a couple months to see how this plays out and if the economy weakens. So the first one would be the Fed. The second one would be a resolution of the trade war with China and the end of tariffs. That would get rid of rising prices. That takes some of the pressure off inflation, takes some of the pressure off profit margins. And finally, the Democrats in January choose to legislate, not investigate. And let's say they work with the president and they pass some kind of infrastructure spending bill, which would be more dollars flowing into the economy. Now, we can hope that, you know, one or maybe all of these could happen. But let me put it this way. I wouldn't bet the ranch on all three or any one of these happening.
And Jim, I found a couple of clips on the economy that I wanted to share with our listeners. One is from an econ professor, and also the other from our good friend Gary Schilling on how the Fed could create the next recession.
The retail CEOs, people like Hubert Joly at Best Buy and Brian Cornell at Target, say it's never been better. You listen to the folks in the automobile business, we're at the end of the cycle. Housing starts seem to be slipping. The medical people, healthcare people are very bullish after the election because it took all these healthcare cuts off the table. Those are now not on the table anymore, and they will continue full steed ahead with healthcare. So we are at the end of a very long cycle, and I think it could continue for several years. But everyone's concerned about risk. The biggest risk they're concerned about, Tyler, is global trade and China trade. They aren't so worried about Europe.
One is the Fed jacks up rates to the point that they kill the economy. Now, the Fed never starts off saying, we're going to kill the economy. We want this baby to go down the tubes. No, no. They just want to cool off what they think is an overheating economy or one that might get that way. And that's where they are now. By my count, they've tried 13 times in the post-World War II period to do that, to cool it off. But in 12 of the 13 times, they got a recession. The only soft landing, in effect, where they did not have a recession, the economy just slowed down a bit, was in the mid-90s. The other cause of recessions are shocks, financial shocks. And that's what we had, as I mentioned earlier, with the dot-com blow-off in the late 90s and the subprime mortgage collapse in the mid-2000s, that the Feds ends up precipitating the next recession. Matter of fact, in portfolios we're managed, we're basically short stocks because I think we are seeing in the stock market sell-off perhaps the last hurrah. And the stock market is a very good leading indicator of the economy, so maybe that's another reason it's telling us that a recession is not too far ahead.
Well, Jim, we just finished a show with some really great news for our listeners. It's not very often we get to talk about being in a situation where things are as good as they can get. But looking ahead, what can our listeners expect in the coming week?
We've got probably three events that we're going to keep our – well, actually four – one would be on November 20th, this trade summit. President will be meeting with the president of China, And it depends on whether you believe a tweet one day or a government spokesman or a cabinet member the other. It would be a resolution to the trade war between China and the U.S. That's coming up on November 20th. Also coming up next week, next Friday, is Black Friday for retailers. So they're going to be looking at, will this be a strong Christmas season, as strong as it was last year or even stronger? That's coming up. And then we have the Fed meeting in December, the last one for the year, where the futures market and everybody pegs the next rate hike is coming. So those are three events, Chris, we're going to be. Oh, and a fourth one is the OPEC meeting in Vienna. We're going to talk about in the next segment. Saudi Arabia is cutting production by 500,000 barrels a day beginning next month. So let's put this in order. We've got a trade summit coming on November 20th. We've got the Black Friday Christmas retail season. We have a Fed FOMC meeting where rate hikes are expected. And we have next month a meeting of OPEC in Vienna. Will they go back to cutting production? And we'll talk about cutting production and what's happening to oil in our next segment. But those are things coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.